Daniel Flitton.
He is diplomatic editor of the Age, as I mentioned. He's a former intelligence analyst for the Australian government and was at one time a university lecturer, I believe at Deakin, specialising in international relations. He's addressed the Institute before. I remember him talking to the Melbourne Writers Festival last year when he gave a very, very well-received speech at that meeting. And it is really with very great pleasure and a great deal of interest that I welcome him back, because I want to hear what he says about Kevin Rudd's world, the PM's global hopes and fears, as much as you all do. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Daniel Flitton.
Thanks, Michael, and to Graham Barrett as well for inviting me today and to the Institute. It is a real pleasure. Just before Christmas last year, Kevin Rudd hosted an evening drinks on the lawns of Kirribilli House in Sydney, and as painful as it is for me as a loyal Victorian to say, it was a really wonderful setting. It's perched just by the harbour. We're looking out at the Opera House, the bridge, and the city. And the gathering there was for about 100 or so of Kevin Rudd's closest friends from around the world. And we were there to discuss the Prime Minister's pet project, his idea to create an Asia-Pacific community and reshape the diplomatic architecture of the Asia-Pacific. There were foreign affairs officials, business leaders, academics, even the odd reporter. And we were there from 22 different countries, the US, China, Japan, Indonesia, right across Southeast Asia and beyond, Chile, Mexico, and we're all there to talk about the future of the Asia-Pacific. Ever the gracious host, Kevin Rudd stood up on a stool to give an impromptu speech about the importance of this gathering. And he spoke about the bonds that Australia has to the region, the opportunity to enhance ties between countries. And just as the PM was in full flight, something really strange happened. Down on the harbour waters, a group had hired a disco boat for the office Christmas party. And there it was, pulling up right alongside Kirribilli House, music blasting out across the water, and a fair bit of drunken singing and dancing going on as well, and incidentally, drowning out this important speech by the Australian Prime Minister. Had the summit been held in many of the countries that were represented there, I reckon it's likely that there would have been an exclusion zone set up with sharpshooters and naval boats on patrol, and that would have kept away these noisy miscreants. But thankfully, that wasn't the case in Australia, and Kevin Rudd, bravely enough, carried on speaking over the din. But the story is perhaps illustrative of Kevin Rudd's global hopes and fears. We have in Rudd a PM bursting with big ideas about Australia's place in the world. His hope to set up a new Asia-Pacific community, a bid for a seat at the United Nations Security Council, pushing for the group of 20 countries to respond to the global economic crisis and giving Australia a seat at that table, reigniting a drive to rid the world of nuclear weapons. But at the same time, there's an accompanying fear. For all of Kevin Rudd's talking, is anybody actually paying attention? Or does the background noise of world affairs simply drown out Australia's voice? One issue that I want to focus on today, I think we can dispense with fairly quickly. What would Kevin Rudd, former career diplomat, consider to be the greatest challenge for Australian foreign policy? Perhaps it's the rise of China. Maybe it's managing the fallout over the attacks on Indians in Melbourne. The war in Afghanistan. Perhaps it's preserving Australia's close ties with the United States, with Barack Obama soon to come to town. But no. These are all worthy issues, but there is one that looms even larger. And that challenge has a name. Tony Abbott. This is an election year, and for Rudd, ensuring that Labor wins government again is the most important element for Australia's national interest. He is, never forget, a politician. So this brings us to the more substantive issue that I wanted to talk about today. How has Rudd performed in foreign affairs? And how should he be judged in the forthcoming election? Now, it's often said that foreign affairs plays little role in the decision-making of the Australian voters, and I've written that too. But I should also admit that this view is more than just a little bit outdated. What is climate change, if not an international issue? We can't separate the health of the economy from the rest of the world. Global affairs might be the backdrop to the retail politics of supermarket prices and tax reform, or the latest thought bubble from Barnaby Joyce, but it's a backdrop that puts everything else into context. And in election year, foreign affairs are still important. So how has this government gone? In policy terms, taking bilateral relations in particular, Rudd has suffered. Let's run through a quick list. Relations with India, stuffed. China, edgy and hostile. Indonesia, tense. Japan, sour. Fiji, Suva kicked out our High Commissioner. It's not a great record, you'd have to say. But that's only if you stop there, as too many commentators and analysts have been prone to do in recent months, and judge foreign relations as if it's some kind of diving contest where we can hold up little scorecards at the end of each performance. Certainly, there have been particular difficulties in bilateral relations. Not all of them of this government's making, some issues that could have been handled far better. But it's important to judge the broader strategic context. It's been a tumultuous world in the short couple of years that Rudd has been in office. We've moved out of a dark episode where misplaced assumptions of unilateral authority did great damage to the conduct of international relations. We emerged in a time of hope, to use a term favoured by President Obama, for cooperation in face of the big problems, such as the economic collapse, to climate change. And now, it appears that that multilateral moment might be over. And that leaves future trends far less certain. Australia has had some big wins. The seat at the G20 leaders' meeting is the most significant achievement for Australia in the past couple of years, provided that the grouping finds an ongoing role. I'm not yet convinced that the G20 can outlast the crisis as the mechanism for coordinating action on the global economy, or that Australia has a natural place at that table. Yet I think Rudd deserves credit for both helping drive the meeting and for so far keeping us there. Nor is Rudd's Asia-Pacific community idea dead in the water, as was proclaimed early. I doubt that a new body will result, yet Kevin Rudd's proposal has achieved something really important. The idea has got countries talking about a way to rationalise the multitude of overlapping leaders' meetings across the region. APEC, the East Asia Summit, the ASEAN Regional Forum, not a leaders' meeting, but in essence to untangle the bowl of spaghetti that is our regional diplomatic architecture. And that conversation will be valuable. And Australia has also made what appears to be a very timely contribution to the debate on nuclear weapons, with the Evans-Kawaguchi report that was released last year, given especially that Rudd decided to set up this commission at a time which predated Barack Obama's Prague speech and his call for a nuclear security summit in Washington in April. Rudd was able to personally hand Obama a copy of this report in December last year and showcase Australia's contribution on what's still an incredibly important issue. Nor do I agree with the Coalition's claim that Australia's Security Council campaign is a waste or a diversion. The resources that are devoted to this bid are minuscule in comparison with other expenditure, particularly in the defence portfolio, and the returns, or the potential returns, are far greater in terms of Australia's engagement around the world, picking up on opportunities to advance Australia's political and business interests, and let's not forget also the chance to strengthen the UN. We should be in a race to beat Luxembourg, otherwise it's like we're handing over judgment on important international issues to the Geelong City Council. And Australia has too big a stake in those questions. But I do want to talk about what I see as a real weakness in the structural approach that this government brings to foreign policy. That weakness has a name. Kevin Rudd. This is not a criticism of the PM's grinning face beaming out from the cover of Time magazine as Australia's global guy, as happened last year. Nor is it because Rudd submitted an essay to the prestigious US journal Foreign Affairs, containing the type of prime ministerial gobbledygook that Australians have fast become familiar and fast become tired of hearing, warning, for instance, that China and the US have a threat of incremental bifurcation, accepting the need to work with the extant political vocabulary within China's national discourse, and even, and I quote again, for some, this might seem a pointless theoretical discussion of political taxonomies. Surprisingly enough, the PM's essay was rejected. But my concern about Rudd is the personification of foreign policy in the form of the Prime Minister. You get very little reward from studying the worldview of Stephen Smith and attempting to understand how this might shape Australia's international attitude. Everything stems from Rudd. Now, that's not automatically a bad thing, but at the moment, the negatives are weighing. It's not really that Rudd has taken an interventionist attitude in foreign policy decision-making to the extent of deciding which nominated diplomats have sufficient language skills to serve abroad as an ambassador. Rudd last year scotched the choice of Hugh Borrowman, a senior official in his own department, denying him a job in Germany and instead attempting to pack him off to Sweden. No, it's because Rudd has created a structure where he is seen not only as the last, but also the first word on foreign policy. Countries, naturally enough, want his direct attention, and they're not satisfied with anything less. It's too much for just one person. And because Rudd is who he is, a former diplomat, Mandarin-speaking specialist on China, once posted to Beijing, he is hostage to his own background and is finding it very difficult to escape this. China, for instance, expected much of Rudd and has wound up confused. The Defence White Paper last year included some strikingly open concerns about China's military ambition, coupled with an obvious reluctance in the government at the time to see China's state-owned companies buy into Australian resource firms. Beijing wondered what had happened to its new best friend. And at the same time, India watched on, convinced that a Sinophile Rudd had taken Australia into China's orbit. This was not helped by Rudd's decision to abandon uranium sales to India and has been torn asunder by the violence that's been directed at Indians in Australia and the media furore that this has generated. Japan, too, saw Rudd as a Chinaman and was suspicious of his plans. Seen in the big picture, some of these bilateral problems, however, can be overcome or understood. Don't forget, China might represent enormous economic opportunity, but the country remains under an authoritarian heel. And frankly, I'm less worried about an unhappy China than a kowtowing Australia. And while I don't agree with the decision not to sell uranium to India, the problem with the exploitation of the Indian students and then the violence that's been directed towards them has grown from seeds that were scattered well before Rudd came to office. Rebuilding trust will take a long time, and there was not a whole lot to start with in Australia-India relations. The most important measure, of course, is to stop the violence and to stop the attacks. And from there, I actually believe that the relationship with India can be much strengthened as a consequence. Rudd is learning. Perhaps more importantly, Smith is learning too, stepping out a little more. He's still cautious, still deep in the shadow of the PM, but Smith has delivered a couple of very strong speeches of late, first to help with the recovery of China relations last year, and just yesterday, finally, explicitly acknowledging the racial elements that are too evident in too many of the attacks on Indians. the signs are that Smith has been heard too. So I'll leave you with a final message, if I may borrow a few phrases from our dear Prime Minister. Frankly, if I may say so, speaking on behalf of the Australian Government, in response to that question on the Prime Minister's global hopes and fears and where he has taken Australia in the world, has he done enough? No. But with his favourite shoulder to the wheel, things are not all doom and gloom. Thanks.
Don't go away, then.
I never thought I'd escape.
Well, thank you very much indeed. And if that hasn't excited a few questions around the place, I'll be most surprised. Who has the first question? Zara, as always.
Zara Kimpton, ain't I?
No one's ever allowed to repeat that I called him Mutt. No.
Daniel, I'm interested in you talking about Rudd in a way being reigning supreme in the foreign policy area over Smith, although at the end you say that Smith is reasserting his position. It reminds me of Michael Wesley, who was the editor of the Our Journal, now the director of the Lowy Institute, wrote a book a couple of years ago about foreign policy in the Howard era. And he came to speak to us at Jollymont about this, and I remember saying to him, what I'm interested in, you've talked about Howard the whole night, but you actually haven't mentioned the name Alexander Downer, and he is the foreign minister, which makes me think, do you think this is a similar situation as how dominant Howard was over Downer, and is this therefore not such an unusual situation?
No, it is unusual because it's the reverse. Howard was not comfortable in foreign affairs. And I shouldn't say he wasn't comfortable, but he looked awkward in foreign affairs right up until the Timor crisis in 99. So he was in office for a good 3 years before he really, really sort of started to hit his straps. And then it was after September 11 that Howard really began to really drive those sorts of foreign policy issues. What's happened here has been the reverse. Rudd, I think, probably more than any Prime Minister that's come to office, felt he had a specialist background in foreign affairs and has made his stamp on that portfolio right from the outset. I mean, in essence, there was a joke going around for a while that Smith was the minister assisting the Prime Minister for Foreign Affairs. Now, as I said in my remarks, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it has, I think, created some weaknesses for this government, and I think it's caused some of the problems that they've encountered, particularly in bilateral relations. Rudd, to me, seems to be much more comfortable in multilateral settings. He doesn't do the bilateral thing quite as well. But I do think it's different from Howard's approach.
Query around the place? Yes?
Can I just ask you to give us a pen picture of each of the principal actors in climate change. Oh. Prime Minister Rudd, Tony Abbott, Barnaby Joyce, there could be a few others. I'll leave it to you because we're all here to learn.
I think one of the things that's been interesting about the climate change debate in Australia in the term of the Rudd government is how little it's actually related to international issues until the lead up to Copenhagen. It was very much a domestic debate about what we were going to do in Australia to address these issues. And in that, the main actors were, at that stage, it was Brendan Nelson to start with, and then Malcolm Turnbull, and of course Rudd, and Penny Wong is the other one who has grown more and more in her role as climate change minister. I don't know quite where we're going to put Barnaby into this nice little spectrum, but we can think about some things about this way. But that's been the debate in Australia up until late last year, when it was an expectation that Copenhagen was actually going to deliver an international agreement. But even then, the debate was framed as Australia has to do this because the rest of the world's going to do something. And when the rest of the world failed to do something, we sort of, it seems to me, we started to realise as a country that this is actually a global issue. and that getting a global agreement on it is very, very difficult. So it has to get beyond individual personalities, and you've got to try and find common areas of interest. Now, Copenhagen was a mess. We learned some lessons from it, though. We learned lessons about China and its approach that it's going to bring to the issue. I don't believe that climate change is going to go away, and we're going to have to come up with a response eventually. There will be domestic costs in that, and that's very uncomfortable for any government to argue. I think that the debate has shifted, though, in the last couple of months particularly, and I think Abbott's run a very effective cut-through campaign to cast doubt on what the government's doing with its ETS. Personally, I always thought the ETS was a mess. I don't get to write on domestic affairs for good reason. But to me, a carbon tax was a much more sensible, simple and effective way of trying to put a price on carbon.
Thank you.
But it's not that it also should say that it's not that you can't do both. You can have a carbon tax and an ETS.
Can I interpose here and ask a question? It's most remiss of me to do this as a chairman, but I'm fascinated by the fact that Rudd and Obama have a very good understanding. President Obama is running into a few domestic problems at home, which is altering the domestic situation over there to a very great extent, and this should have flow-on effects to Australia. He's also very good friends with Gordon Brown, and Mr. Brown, it appears to me, from this distance, is in a bit of trouble running up to a general election in Great Britain. So how does that impinge? Say there's a change, just for argument's sake, say there's a change of government in Great Britain and President Obama's policies in relation to climate change and a few other things, international affairs, have to be modified. How does this affect Mr. Rudd's approach to foreign affairs?
Look, I haven't been looking at it too closely, Michael, but my understanding is that we don't have to say if, it's a when there's a change of government in Britain. I think we sometimes make too much of close friendships between political leaders. They are very important, and Rudd was very eager to make it seem that he was close to Obama right from the outset. I do think that they share a lot of similar approaches to issue in that they are both sort of policy wonks, and in that sense, they probably share something with Gordon Brown, but I think Brown is going to be shifted out of the picture. But in terms of the difficulties that they're both encountering, that's what governing is all about. And one of the things I actually would sort of reluctant to make calls about what's going to happen in elections, but you know, there was some talk after Massachusetts, the Senate race in the United States, that Obama might be a one-term president, and he sort of fielded this himself. Well, frankly, I reckon you've got more chance of Rudd being a one-term prime minister than you've got of Obama being a one-term president. And it's not to say that it's not impossible either, but I think Rudd's actually in a bit more trouble than Obama is. But Obama's less into his term than Rudd is. They seem to work well together. You hear lots of stories about the way in which they communicate with one another privately, but I don't think that happens so much with Obama and Rudd. I think that's more Rudd trying to deal with other leaders. It's a good thing that Obama's coming to Australia because it focuses the Americans on Australia and it focuses them on our region, more importantly as well, when they've got a lot on their plate. But I think. The narrative of personality-driven policy is an easy story for the media to tell because you've got characters, but I think often we kind of make it up a bit too.
Not the media.
Really.
Yes. You mentioned that Kevin Rudd seems to perform better in multilateral environments rather than bilateral relationships. Why do you think that is? Is it personality or circumstance or priority?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of both those things. And again, I'm going to make it up. It is my impression that his personality is better suited to those sorts of I'm going to work the room type of arrangements, and when he can go into a meeting and they're all sitting around a table and he can say something and get people's attention and get them talking about that sort of thing, it seems to work for him. The bilateral settings are often more difficult because you do get into nitty-gritty type of issues, whereas when you're in that multilateral setting, you're soaring over the big issues. And if you go and you have a look at the failed foreign affairs essay, for instance, there's an awful lot in it, 28 pages, turgid, some of it. What was it, Laurie Oakes said? Sludge. But it is very much the big picture. And I think that's what Rudd does very well. But when he's talking about getting closer into the weeds, that's where he struggles. And I think that that's becoming clear in things like the Japan relationship, which was troubled early because he decided not to go to Japan and went to China first. Now, I didn't think that was too big a deal, but the Japanese were upset about it. It's been fixed because he's been back to Japan several times since. China relations, India relations too. I mean, I do think that India relations are a real problem.
This is a question disguised as an observation, really. You mentioned that in relation to the Security Council meeting, Luxembourg was like being the Geelong City Council. Don't forget that people said that of the last time we ran for the Security Council, and it's important to note that that when you have a contested vote for the Security Council, you always have problems. In this case, Australia is running against Finland. Finland will get home by a country mile, and therefore it's a race for the second position, and the second position is Australia versus Luxembourg plus the European Union. And you must never underestimate the clout of the European Union. If you add up the embassies that the European Union has abroad, in addition to the embassies that the members of the European Union have abroad, even if Luxembourg doesn't have very many, they have a widespread in the world, and they have enormous political and economic clout. So we're not taking on the Geelong City Council.
No,
we're taking on a lot more.
But I think,
and we're interrupting what was an agreed slate, something that people don't like all that much.
But most slates get interrupted these days. I think, Liz, if you look at the last lot of campaigns, and Canada's had the same experience, just running up to their election. And my point about the Geelong City Council is not to say that we're not running against serious opposition. I do think we are running against serious opposition. I agree with you totally. It's hard to run against the EU. My point is actually about strengthening the role of the United Nations. And I don't think that we have creating as much strength on the UN Security Council as we could otherwise. I would rather see Australia there rather than Luxembourg. So I think that's the argument for. It's not to say about the horse race. The horse race itself is going to be really tough. I mean, interestingly, we've managed to convince the Netherlands to vote for us. And we've managed to convince quite a few of the Europeans, at least at this stage, they've said that they're going to vote for us. But you're absolutely right. We're in a very tough race. But I think, though, that it's much better in the end to have Australia on the council than it is to have Luxembourg.
Can I ask another question? Then I'll come to you, sir. As a former diplomat, Mr. Rudd has travelled extensively, both as a former diplomat and as a prime minister. Do you think that I'm now speaking in political terms, do you think that the Australian public is as interested in prime ministers having overseas trips and talking with all these people around the world and doing all these sorts of things than they are in having a prime minister at home trying to fix the problems here?
No, it's a really good point, because I was thinking about this in the context of putting together my remarks for today. Last time I spoke to the Institute, it was just early in Rudd's term, and I, at that time, did a survey of everywhere that I thought he was likely to be going in his first year in office. And he totaled up some incredible number of kilometres and some incredible amount of carbon emitted, not all from a jet plane. But Rudd's travel, they've tried to turn this into an issue with the Kevin 747. Rudd's travel in an election year is going to be really interesting, because he's got a few things that he's going to desperately want to go to. He's going to want to go to the Obama Nuclear Security Summit, and that's in April. He's got APEX coming up later in the year, which he's going to make sure that he's going to try and get to. He'll have EAS, and he'll have all these other things. I think that's going to be a political challenge for him to manage. But the other thing, too, is that Rudd just seems to do it all with his internal nuclear reactor running all the time. And he's just, you know, he just gets off the plane and he's back and he's bouncing around with energy and all of his ideas again. How this plays out for the Australian public, it's a trickier one to judge. It's a very easy tabloid story, and it does annoy people when they see jet-setting, and it's very easy to get the cost and that sort of thing. And what it's difficult for governments to do is to always communicate the value, because they're often sort of, you know, more in the relationships that you make and the fact that you're there, and that Australia is represented at a high level, but it may not actually produce an outcome at a particular time. I think people understand that, but they do think that Rudd travels too much. But I don't think he's going to do any of these big 18-day odysseys this year.
So,
my question is about our future financial relations with China. Do you feel uncomfortable that as we are moving, we are going to be in a position where if China makes a proposition to us regarding minerals, particularly iron ore, that we are not going to be in a position to refuse their request?
I don't really foresee, just the premise of your question is that it would necessarily be a negative. And I don't really think that that necessarily has to be the case, because one of the things that I don't think the Chinese, I actually heard someone speaking on this morning, but one of the things that I don't think the Chinese did very well last year was the way in which they approached the buy-up of Australian resources. It seemed to me, and I'm going to generalise, but it seems to me that the Chinese had a view that in order to secure these resources, they had to own them. And I think that that was a profoundly mistaken view, because ultimately we're always going to want to sell them. We just want to sell them at the right price. And so I think that our relationship with China that we had, particularly through last year but earlier too, and the difficulties that surrounded the Rio Chinalco deal and some of those questions, that they were learning experiences for both sides. And I think that we will learn from those, and that those things will become easier. It's true, China is going to have an enormous impact on our economy and consequently on our politics, because that's the way of the future now, it seems. But China will also stumble and it'll stutter. Their growth won't always improve, if you believe the figures, and I don't. But their growth won't always be 9 and 10%. And then they'll have their own internal problems, and it'll be just like the difficulties of relating to any country. So I'm not particularly concerned about China in that respect. Just one down here. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I was just going to ask the question. Yesterday, Barnaby Joyce made a few comments about Australia being unable to pay or repay their foreign debts back. I'm interested to hear from you about how much you think that might affect our reputational damage overseas to foreign investors, say. And also, if you do, just looking back with your things that you criticised Rudd for, it seems like there's that tension between domestic politics always and then foreign affairs politics, and you seem to have always chosen to pander in the areas that he's failed, according to you, sort of in the domestic sphere rather than the foreign sphere. And how do you sort of see that playing out in the next year or so?
Just on the first question, I don't think Barnaby's comments will have any impact at all. It's just Barnaby, and people are working out who Barnaby is. I don't know, and perhaps I didn't explain myself well enough, I don't know that there's always a tension. I think it's just reality. I don't believe you can separate domestic and foreign affairs. When I was still teaching, I used to talk to my students about this notion of intermestic, international and domestic combined together, and that was such a ugly phrase. But I do think it's kind of right. If you look at technology, for instance, and the way in which some foolish banker who shows a few scantily clad pictures on a TV screen, and how this can flash around the world, and it actually tells a story about Australia. That's part of our diplomacy in a way, not a formal part, but it's certainly part of the image. Perhaps I should say it's part of the images of Australia, and that sort of thing goes on all of the time, and that can have an impact on politics as well. There was just again on the silly YouTube things, but you know there was that famous thing that came up during the campaign of Kevin Rudd picking his earwax, which ended up in the United States. I mean, what sort of a message does that send about Australia? But these sorts of things, yes, you cannot separate the international and the local in that respect. And it's absolutely critical for the economy. And we saw that with the global economic crisis. Rudd will keep saying that Australia is the only country to have escaped recession. Well, it really depends on how you technically define a recession. I mean, they technically call it two quarters of successive negative growth. But, I mean, really, we had a recession. We just had a very shallow one. Remember, these are the same people who are telling us this was going to be the worst recession since the Great Depression. It was a credibility problem there. But, yeah, I don't think you can sort of separate the two things. I think that they are just one. It's just the whole field.
Daniel, thank you very much indeed. I enjoyed it immensely, particularly your opening with the boat, with the drunken Sydneysiders drowning out the Prime Minister's speech. I think that's terrific, actually. I think that's typically Australian. It reminds me of when Harold Holt disappeared. I thought it was fabulous that an Australian Prime Minister was able to go for a swim without helicopters overseas over his head and disappear. Now, there was...
Harold,
that wasn't good for Harold, no, not at the time. But there was an Australian Prime Minister standing at Jubilee House, lovely place, trying to make... making a speech, and drunken Sydneysiders listening to jazz. I think that's epitomises...
It wasn't jazz.
The epitomises the way Australia has developed over the years, and I'm, in a sense, particularly grateful that we've been able to maintain that. And I'm particularly grateful that we've been able to maintain foreign editors such as you, who are telling us what's going on with your background in analysis, security analysis, intelligence analysis, and all that, to give us what I found to be a most thought-provoking and informative speech. And I would like everybody to join with me in thanking very much indeed Daniel Flitton for his attendance here today. But also, again, thank you very much indeed.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, I try to finish everything just about on time. It's almost 2 o'clock. That's when we finish. Thank you so much for your attendance. Please come again, not only here, but also down to our other location. We'd love to see even more of you around the place. But in the meantime, thank you again and safe trip home. I declare the meeting closed.